We interrupt this broadcast with some important news.
Let's rewind and check out the biggest news stories from this week. It's time for Taiwan This Week.
Good evening and welcome to Taiwan This Week with me, your host, Gavin Phipps. And I'm joined in the studio this evening by Sean Su.
Nice to be here.
And from Taichung by Donovan Smith.
Great to be back.
And we'll begin today's show with the latest news about the rather worrying food poisoning cases in Taipei this week. And the Deputy Health Minister, Victor Wong, said that forensic examinations have found that bongkrekic acid was in the blood of one of the two people who have died after dining at a Malaysian restaurant chain in Taipei's Xinyi district. Five other people remain in critical condition, and apparently the number of people reporting illnesses after dining at the restaurant now stands at 18. Now, according to the Deputy Health Minister, the examination revealed the presence of the rare toxin in the blood of one of the deceased, making it the first time that bongkrekic acid has been detected in Taiwan. However, he went on to say that the discovery of the toxin is not the final conclusion, and the exact cause of death and information concerning the presence of the toxin will be released, well, by prosecutors after they've carried out more comprehensive assessments of the case. There have been reports as well that maybe someone who worked in the restaurant or someone attached to the restaurant somehow was maybe meddling with the food, Sean.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a lot of speculation while this case is being looked at, granted that there's two deaths and what have you. But for one thing, it feels like, you know, being vegetarian food, one really wonders how this even came about. Obviously, this restaurant wasn't deemed high risk, because if it has been, Taiwan's officials and inspectors would inspect restaurants at minimum two times a year, and even more if they're deemed high risk. So it's not like this restaurant has a history. The last time they inspected the restaurant was 2022. So, you know, I do understand why people might speculate that there's foul play involved, because it's not every day that somebody either leaves coconut, rice, and all the things out on such a situation where it's so bad that, you know, people can easily get sick.
And of course, Sean, they've tied down the dates of when people possibly got poisoned at the restaurants.
Yeah, and it's like a week apart. So, you know, that's a lot of time to, there's training also involved, standardized training in a lot of these restaurants. And in Taiwan malls, like, things are generally kept clean to a certain degree because they don't want, you know, publicity like this. It can really hurt. And Xinyi happens to have one of the highest densities of malls in the world. So, you know, these companies that run these malls usually run a tight ship. So it's quite surprising that this can happen there. There's going to be a lot of speculation until we get more news and we find out exactly what has been killing these two people and getting all these people sick. Time will tell.
And Donovan, I mean, do you think this is scaring people to go out dining?
I haven't heard any data on that. I'm sure there are probably some people who think that way. But I just saw a report that, restaurant spending has been up, but I believe that data was collected prior to this incident. Now, I mean, in the past, there have been cases where something has come up and dining has taken a little bit of a dip. But I think that this is Malaysian food, that it's not a local dish with the same kind of local ingredients. I think more people will kind of think of it as, oh, it's a foreign food problem, not a domestic one. So I'd be surprised if there's a major hit to the hospitality industry across the board. It wouldn't surprise me if, for example, Southeast Asian restaurants or even other foreign cuisines took a little bit more of a hit, maybe a few percentage points for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, indeed. In Taiwan, I think Southeast Asian food is generally tends to be localized to Southeast Asians, other than, I think, certain sandwiches from Vietnamese food that's been getting popular over the years. But other than that, the vast majority of these places tend to be frequented by, migrants or what have you. This restaurant in particular, maybe not sure. But again, it's vegetarian Malaysian food, which in itself is quite a niche in Taiwan. And given how many restaurants restaurants they are here and how often people eat out, I don't think they're going to change their habits. Will they avoid vegetarian Malaysian restaurants? Well, first you have to look at people who are vegetarian and want specifically Malaysian food, which I don't think is it's long tail. It's not something that's mainstream. So I like Donovan said, I don't believe there is going to be a much change of habits at all for the vast majority of people here.
And moving on now, and the Ma Ying-jeou Foundation on Monday of this week announced that the former head of state will travel to China next month. Now, according to Foundation Director Xiao Shu-tsun, Ma will be leading a delegation of students from the Foundation's Dazhou Academy to China from April the 1st through the 11th, a part of Ma's Cross-Strait Youth Exchange Program policy. The delegation will be visiting Guangdong, Shanxi provinces, and also Beijing, where they'll be meeting with students at the Beijing University. They'll also be meeting with students at the Sun Yat-sen University in Guangdong. Now, Xiao told reporters that Ma firmly believes that such exchanges between students from both sides of the Taiwan Strait are vital to building friendships and understanding, and also helpful to lowering the chance of conflict. The China's Taiwan Affairs Office issued a statement welcoming Ma's planned visit. Now, the foundation director said the delegation has made no plans to meet with Chinese officials, but specific arrangements will be left up to the Chinese side, which is hosting the delegation. And then came talk of Ma meeting with old friends while in China. And one of the old friends, apparently, is, according to the Ma Ying-jeou Foundation, one Mr. Xi Jinping. Now, speaking in a radio interview, Xiao Shu-tsun said that Ma could meet with Xi when he travels to Beijing. And he went on to say, despite Ma currently being just a regular citizen, based on the important history that Ma and Xi made together in 2015, of course, he hopes there is an opportunity to see his old friend. Now, the KMT was busy cheering those comments, with Vice Chairman Andrew Shah telling a meeting of the party's Central Standing Committee that it would be great if Ma happens to meet with his old friend Xi. Now, the DPP wasn't too happy about it, with certain members of that party saying, well, not such nice things about the meeting. But Premier Chen Jianren was very diplomatic, and he told reporters that he fully respects plans for Ma's itinerary, but he hopes the former president will tell Xi, if they meet, that Taiwan is a sovereign, independent nation. Now, Ma's office shot back at the Premier's Taiwan is a sovereign, independent notion comment and released a statement accusing certain people of violating the ROC constitution and also explaining that Taiwan is not a country, but a part of China as defined by the ROC. The foundation went on to say that, well, the Premier's comments seem to go against the ROC constitution and also the act governing relations between the people of the Taiwan area and the mainland area, as both of those state that the relationship between the two sides of the strait is not that of two countries. So, Sean, of course, Ma went there the same time last year with a group of students. But this year, it appears the ante has been up somewhat, with the name of Xi Jinping now being bandied around.
Yeah, I feel like this is like a kind of an April Fool's joke, personally, because, you know, he did this last year and he brought about 30 students there. And then this year, it's now, I believe the reports say it's about 20 university students from Taiwan. So that feels like a one-third drop, regardless of what the final count will be. Under the guise of, you know, exchange students who will be brought from Taiwan to visit, you know, Guangdong, Shanxi, Beijing, in what are obviously, as we've seen from other similar visits for other countries or influencers or, you know, what have you, these trips will not show the everyday life or normal life of China. They're all only going to show these students the most positive aspects of China. And in regards to Ma Ying-jeou, look, even if he meets Xi Jinping again, I mean, what will be the tangible benefits for Taiwan as a nation? And I don't really think they can actually do anything. Xi Jinping will not suddenly say, well, you know, I'm not going to do all this aggressive behavior. I'm not going to send daily, you know, plane patrols, you know, violating or crossing the median line or going into airspace that Taiwan deems sensitive. They're not going to suddenly change just because of Ma Ying-jeou. We know that. So the only thing this really promotes is maybe Ma Ying-jeou with his core base within the KMT and the deep, you know, perhaps some of the old guard in the KMT. I don't see it really appealing to everyday regular people, especially with the way, you know, Taiwanese people feel about identity and all that. So I really wonder whose ego this is stroking, is how I see this.
Yeah, this is the second year he's doing this, and I'm getting the suspicion that he does want to make this an annual thing. That sort of is the vibe that's coming off of this. There's some interesting things from the trip in the past, the last one. The one thing that he did do is he went to his ancestral home for tomb sweeping. And that did seem to mean quite a lot to him personally. And if I remember correctly, he cried during that. So there's a personal component to this. But the rest of the trip, probably the tightest summation of his thinking was that DW interview that he gave just before the election in January. But a lot of those statements that he put in that interview, he had said at various different points in various different interviews, including on the trip last year. And, I suspect he's going to come out with a lot of these kinds of defeatist sort of comments again. You know, that Taiwan can't win a war with China, and that, you know, as he would call it, reunification should, you know, is inevitable, but it'll take maybe a couple decades. He's going to probably say some of these things. His fig leaf for the KMT, this is what he did last time, is he made repeated references to things like the Republic of China, which is a little bit of a no-no on the PRC. But that's no problem, really, on the PRC side, because the United Front there will just edit out all those bits and then show the public what they want to see. So the only people who actually hear him making some of these stronger statements are the people who are physically on site. But we get to hear them here because of the Taiwan media will take, you know, broadcast that all directly. But there will be all these news bites in China with these kinds of quotes, and it's a big win for the CCP. Because they can edit it exactly how they want it to appear. And Ma, knowing the kinds of things that he's been saying in the last few years, is probably going to give them pretty much exactly what they want.
And Donovan, what about the Premier's comment? I mean, take into consideration and stress that Taiwan is a sovereign, independent nation while there. And of course, the Ma Ying-jeou Foundation shot back going, hold on there, Hoss, you're violating the ROC Constitution.
Well, back in January, I believe it was an indictment from the U.S. Department of Justice for a dual Taiwanese U.S. national, referred specifically to the Republic of Taiwan. So there's an official government, U.S. government document out there currently referring to Taiwan as the Republic of Taiwan. But anyway, that's a side note. Now, this is a pretty typical tit-for-tat between the KMT and the DPP, particularly when you consider that this guy is the head of the Ma Ying-jeou Foundation, which is much more on the deep blue end side of the KMT, and they lean in very heavily onto the, you know, Republic of China nationalism and the Constitution. So that wing of the party and the head of his foundation is going to actually, he's going to think that way. He's going to believe that through and through in his heart. And that's why he got into a tiff, because he's upset about it. I'm sure that Ma Ying-jeou completely agrees with it. Now, I mean, when it comes to the defending, Chen Jianren's comment about the second part of that, is about the defending of the sovereignty. Right now, of course, you know, the CCP is testing Taiwan's territorial integrity is coming about as close as it possibly can to doing that without actually going into territorial waters, but it's pushing it. And I guess you could say that it is actually doing it around Jinmen right now. So the situation in Jinmen is disturbing. Obviously, accidents have happened, and things, you know, there could be more. But I do think that, you know, that this is the way that they're going to talk. I don't think that Ma Ying-jeou is going to be able to get any concessions out of them on anything to do with territorial integrity or sovereignty. the best he might, if he's dreaming and gets all of his wishes, is maybe China will lift an import ban on some agricultural good. I think that's about as good as you can possibly hope for.
Yeah, I don't foresee, like I said earlier, I just don't see anything really tangible on a permanent scale that can actually be changed out of this. Whatever China does, it's definitely going to be at best something very reversible, whenever they want it, just like you said, the agricultural thing. So, at the end of the day, I think this is another one of Ma Ying-jeou's things where he, makes himself the center of attention for a little bit.
But do you think someone has given him a copy of the U.S. Department of Justice's report?
and if they do, he's going to be upset about it, because, he's a staunch Chinese nationalist, or some say ethno-nationalist. And so when it comes to that, a Chinese race-based nation is his steal. I just want to point out the 1991 amendments to the same constitution that he touts all the time says that the ROC only rules over free China. So his insistence that it might be more than that is extra constitutional.
Moving on now, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs this week confirmed that Vice President-elect Xiaobi Kim visited the European Parliament at the invitation of lawmakers there last week. The statement came as Xiao had been making what officials here are calling, or were calling, low-key tours of the US and Europe. Now, according to the Foreign Ministry, Xiao was welcomed by the President of the European Parliament and the European Parliament's first Vice President. The visit meant that Xiao was the first Vice President-elect of Taiwan to ever visited the European Parliament. Xiao also visited Lithuania, where she held closed-door meetings with two of the country's presidential candidates. She held talks with Czech Senate Speaker Miloš Vystrčil in Prague and spoke at a think tank in Poland. Now, the Foreign Ministry said that Xiao's trip was aimed at strengthening ties between Taiwan and European countries and helping the European Parliament to better understand their situation in the Taiwan Strait. Now, while the government here was using the words low-key tours, low-key was not something the Europeans she met were thinking about, as they merrily posted photographs of their meetings on social media. And needless to say, Beijing was not too happy about this, as a Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson called on the Czech government to severely restrain certain of its politicians and take effective measures to remove the negative influence of what the spokesperson called this incident. Xiao arrived back here in Taiwan on Tuesday. So, Donovan, low-key visits that weren't so low-key.
Actually, it was and wasn't. In other words, that before she went into any of these countries, it was very low-key. Like, for example, when she went to Lithuania, the press didn't report anything about her coming. And that was pretty much true everywhere else. It is that there was not a lot of reporting or buzz prior to her arriving. But then she'd suddenly pop up in one country, and then she popped up in another country, and then she popped up, in the European Parliament in another country. And once she'd already arrived, then she'd leave with something of a bang. So it was kind of a low-key, under the radar, into the country and out with a big bang and a splash. So I think that was the pattern through the whole thing. And that makes sense, because by coming in low-key and ostensibly as a private citizen, China can't get ahead of the situation and try and put a lot of pressure to stop these countries from allowing her in. But once it's a fait accompli, then all China can do is bleat and pound their fists on the table and jump up and down and cry. The other thing that I think is really quite important about this trip is that Xiao is famously very well familiar with the United States. And obviously she partially grew up there. Her mother's is American. Obviously her English is absolutely perfect. And so she's very, very familiar with the way Americans think. She did, by all accounts, a fantastic job in Washington, D.C. I have heard some chatter, though, from some people who would know, that she's not that familiar with Europe and with Europeans thinking. So I think that this trip could be very valuable, because, obviously William Lai, who's educated at Harvard, he's familiar with the Americans. Xiaobi Kim's familiar with the Americans. and Joseph Wu is probably going to leave. So getting some, first-hand European experience, listening to them in their country, and speaking with them in sort of their more natural environment, I think this may help her to sort of get some insights into what's going on in European capitals.
I also think that this is a very prudent move, entering a nation quietly and then, pouncing and then getting away with a bang, definitely sounds like, her namesake, which is a little bit of cat warrior diplomacy, which is very different from the other kind of diplomacy on the other side of the strait, which is wolf warrior diplomacy, which has alienated quite a few nations. Lithuania, of course, and all these actually nations are quite concerned about one of China's strong friends, Russia, and their action towards the Ukraine. So therefore, it's not surprising to see that these nations, like Lithuania especially, trying to, and Czech Republic, having a stronger ties with Taiwan. So I really think this is more of Bi Kim-shiao's excellent diplomatic maneuvering. I think even though she's gaining more information about, the EU, especially the Eastern EU nations, but I think, doing this was, very savvy, just extremely savvy. She could have waited until, she was put in as vice president, but she did not. She took action immediately. I think this just underscores why the DPP is generally regarded in Taiwan as better for international relations, because they do these kinds of moves, which is a huge contrast to what we're saying earlier about Ma Ying-jeou. And to add to this, as we know, Lithuania had a history with being a Soviet state, so they were not happy. So obviously they changed the vast majority of Lithuanians, even citizens in the Czech Republic, in recent polls or surveys, and I'm not sure the full data, but what I do have is that they seem to actually support Taiwan, or they like Taiwan very much, much more so than China. So her moves in doing this is really smart. As for Poland, though, it's kind of understandable. Poland does have a lot of relations with China, so they're a little bit low key on that front, but. Again, I think she's been meeting the right people. I think she's been doing a strong job. And whoever, the Lai administration chooses to do diplomacy will carry on from, I think, Bi Kim-shiao's good reputation. Her being there is great.
And of course, do you think there'll be a bit of a void when it comes to giving the next foreign minister?
I think given Bi Kim-shiao's track record, she will be able to manage from afar. And her showing up early is really the right move, because ultimately, I think it demonstrates that when it comes to international diplomacy, the buck will stop with her. So her actually meeting these people will set an underscoring that she has personally met with a lot of these decision makers or political influencers, so to speak. And so I think it's all good for Taiwan. Now, China's actions, did not work so well. Their wolf warrior diplomacy, their warnings, will feel empty, because, they're not going to take actual actions here. Or nothing really tangible, but, people will notice and say, again, as usual, China's giving threats as soon as Taiwan just existing. So I feel like, this works out really well.
And Donovan, I mean, obviously the Lai administration will appoint a new foreign minister, but do you think that maybe the incoming vice president might overshadow the incoming foreign minister?
That's a good question, and I don't have a good answer for you. However, whoever it depends a lot, I think, on who the foreign minister is that comes in. Obviously, Joseph Wu has been extremely talented and effective. If somebody of that caliber comes in, I don't think they will necessarily be overshadowed, but rather seen as an important part of the team. And sort of the model for this is, of course, Tsai Ing-wen herself. Formerly, she kind of came out of trade negotiations, and she was the head of the Mainland Affairs Council, and was educated in the U.S. and U.K. And so she had a lot of foreign policy chops coming in as president. Now, obviously, as president, and this is also true of the vice president, you can't really go out of the country except to visit those 13 countries that recognize Taiwan. They're limited in what they can do geographically. So the impact of the president and the vice president can only be effectively utilized by and large when people from other countries visit. And of course the top people in other countries, except the ones that diplomatically recognize us, aren't going to be able to come. So the foreign minister will still play a crucial role, because foreign minister can travel and go and, you know, can be involved in these other countries, communicating Taiwan's message in those countries, which, again, the president and vice president can only do via Zoom.
But, of course, come May the 20th, a certain Tsai Ing-wen will no longer be president. Donovan, do you see her maybe traveling around the world as a private citizen?
Yeah, I've been giving a lot of thought to that. I'm very curious to see if she takes up a role like that. My guess is she'll probably take a few weeks off. She probably deserves a rest. I've been giving a lot of thought to that she might be tapped as an unofficial emissary for the country. Now, whether she would accept that or would want to do it is another matter, and I don't really have a good answer to that because, you know, I can't peer into her head. But I could see that if she was willing to do it, I think she'd be extraordinarily effective at it.
And I see that what's going on with for these countries, what's going on with Russia and Ukraine is only going to encourage more potentially. One thing is that more potentially transits. Tsai Ing-wen was able to do transits to visit other nations technically, right? So I do believe that they will be doing transits more across nations, and then I do believe that as these countries are very concerned about China's alliance with Russia. And, you know, given their wolf warrior diplomacy, that I feel that more of them will be tempted to go into, you know, and they'll find cat warrior diplomacy more appealing.
But do you think Tsai Ing-wen will become like a pseudo diplomat when she retires from the president job?
I think she would do. She might. If she were to do that, I do feel that it would be more effective for Taiwan's status versus what Ma Ying-jeou is doing. So Ma Ying-jeou is already talking to China. She could just easily, and of course, she's definitely not welcome in China. So I do imagine that Tsai Ing-wen sooner or later will actually be tapped from time to time to come out.
And moving away
that.
From
Absolutely.
That issue now and looking at a trade issue, while the Ministry of Foreign Affairs this week called on members of the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership to release detailed guidelines for countries seeking membership in the bloc. Now, the call comes as the government here is voicing concerns that the official accession process guidelines are not detailed enough. Now, according to the Ministry's Department of International Cooperation and Economic Affairs, the partnership's Auckland principles, which provide three main principles for applicants to meet, are also vague. And Department Head Lien Yu Ping told reporters that those principles simply ask potential members to be prepared to undertake the high quality and high standards embedded in the pact and to demonstrate success in upholding the commitments of past trade agreements. The Foreign Office official went on to say that Taiwan is engaged in direct dialogue with key member states that are more Taiwan-friendly, including Japan and Canada, and the Foreign Ministry plans to send delegations to other member states later this year to solicit support for Taiwan's accession to the trade bloc. So, Sean, it sounds like to me when they said that they don't understand the rules, or maybe they need them explained. Maybe they haven't been translated into Chinese.
I think this is a strategic move to set out, detailed guidelines to make sure that, to basically see what Taiwan can do, especially against Chinese opposition. Of course, China is not in the CPTPP, but, that's going to be the first major problem, because China's definitely going to throw its weight around to encourage all the other members to do something and make sure that Taiwan is excluded. The second issue is, I think Taiwan needs to do is, you know, getting clear guidelines might give Taiwan some leeway, especially because Taiwan will have to do domestic reforms to comply with CPTPP standards, especially in industries where Taiwan does protect itself, such as agriculture. So it would not be compliant with general trade block rules. So that's one area that I believe that Taiwan will have to sort out, especially with this administration and the next administration would probably, you know, earn the ire of certain agricultural lobbying groups, which is actually pretty strong in Taiwan. And they would not like that at all. So the food imports is going to be very challenging because, you know, as you know, there's a lot of suspicion throughout Asia regarding certain Japanese agricultural exports, especially from the Sendai region. And that is a very, you know, tricky political issue because radiation and what have you is something that people are still concerned about. So that will be something where will be challenging locally as well. So having clear guidelines would help that in that front. The other issue is that China is the world's second largest economy. Taiwan ranks around 20th. So that will be another issue to contend with. There's also Taiwan's chips. Even though most of the member nations are not strong in that, Japan is. And I do know like other countries such as Korea, you know, would not really like the idea of certain Korean parties would not like the idea of Taiwan having more advantages by being in such a trade bloc. So these are areas where I think Taiwan will have to navigate through. It's not going to be easy. This is a strategic move to lay down solid guidelines so Taiwan can lay out its maneuvering space.
Well, okay, I think there are two things going on here, which I can add to what Sean was saying. I think that another reason that the government here wants clear guidelines is it makes it harder for other countries who are already in the bloc to weasel out of allowing Taiwan in. In other words, it's kind of a calling of bluff sort of thing. So if a country's, you know, comes out against Taiwan, if the rules are clear and Taiwan obviously meets all the rules, then that country's kind of shamed into having to basically admit that, yeah, we're not letting them in because China. So I think that's part of the reason why Taiwan wants that clarity, because it will make it harder for countries to get away with just don't want them. However, the thing is, and the reason why I say it's calling the bluff is because if you look at the history of this, the CPTPP came out of the original TPP, which was a U.S. initiative, and the whole idea was to create a trade bloc that excluded China. And then, of course, the Trump administration pulled out of the pact. But, at its origins, the idea of this whole project was to create a bloc that could exclude China, and they wanted to, you know, and also, possibly kick out or possibly not allow in other countries. So they're not going to be too super detailed, and also because they wanted to get everyone on board, so they kind of couldn't be super detailed in a lot of ways about the accession process, because it was intended to be something of a closed club that they would only allow in the people they wanted to allow in. So I think those are two other things to add to Sean's comments.
Oh, yeah. And another thing is that the National Development Council believes that it can grow Taiwan's economy by about 2%. And it's also worth noting that currently, with just the current members of the CPTPP, it makes up 13.5% of the global GDP. So this isn't a small market. All of these countries will be dependent on Taiwan's chips, as, you know, Taiwan's Taiwan produces the vast majority of you know, the high-end chips there. And when it comes to AI chips, it's almost 100%. So these are issues that will happen. And furthermore, timing is also really important. You know, because South Korea, you know, their biggest competitor for TSMC in Taiwan is Samsung. And Samsung does have heavy influence over the South Korean government, and they plan to join too. So there's going to be a lot of hurdles for Taiwan on the way, because it's not in the interest of South Korea necessarily to have Taiwan in the CPTPP in terms of an economic or chips competitiveness standpoint. So yeah, all of this is going to be quite challenging in the future. But the benefits for Taiwan is great. So hopefully maybe Taiwan can make it.
And as Sean mentioned, chips and AI there. Well, there was some AI-related news this week, as it was reported that NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang was speaking to a gathering of Taiwanese people in Silicon Valley recently, and he said that Taiwan is in the middle of the new AI revolution. Huang, who of course is Tainan born, went on to say that Taiwan's position in the AI revolution must be celebrated. And Huang also called himself a very good ambassador of Taiwan because he understands the importance of Taiwan at the centre of this new computing revolution. Now, meanwhile, here in Taiwan, President-elect Lai Ching-te, who was on a two-month tour of the island's industrial landscape, met with some of the leaders in the drone and chip industries this week for talks focusing on artificial intelligence and how Taiwan can stay at the heart of the AI revolution. Now, according to Lai, he's committed to keeping Taiwan at the heart of said revolution. So, Sean, you know all about AI. Is Taiwan at the heart of the revolution, at the lead of the revolution, or is it sort of somewhere at the back of the revolution?
It's actually completely in the lead. It's not only in the lead, it's practically the only company, practically. The reason I say that is because 100% of... Well, first of all, let's step back for 1 second. NVIDIA makes nearly, you know, the vast majority of the AI chips being used right now. And a lot of companies are actually quite rated right now by how many of NVIDIA's latest AI chips that they have. There's quite a few. Right now, there's been this poaching war where companies are trying to get as much AI talent as they can, and engineers are known to say, well, you know, call me back when your company has over 1,000 or 10,000 AI GPUs, otherwise they can't actually function. So just because you have the engineers but you don't have the hardware, then you can't function. So therefore, the entire planet right now is entirely dependent on NVIDIA for their AI chips. There are competitors, but they don't really factor so far at this point. And here's the other thing. 100% of NVIDIA's latest chips and 100% of their AI chips are made by one company in the world. And they're all made, TSMC, and they're all made in Taiwan. So, of course, right now, Jensen Huang will have to pretend that TSMC, or actually outright say that TSMC is his best friend. There's only very few chips that NVIDIA makes that's outside of Taiwan, and those are like low-end GPUs, like 1050. They're very old 1050 GPUs used usually in an office setting, and those are made by Samsung. So yeah, their future 2 nanometer chips, all their current 7 nanometer, 4 nanometer chips are all made by TSMC. So of course, and not to mention future AI is predicted to, you know, explode. A lot of companies are using them, because they can automate many tasks or conduct tasks simply by texting, which makes it a lot easier than knowing which buttons to press and so forth, so on and so forth. So in that aspect, Jensen Huang has the monopoly right now, and Taiwan has the monopoly on AI chips.
So Donovan, according to Sean there, Jensen Huang got it wrong, because Taiwan's not in the middle, but it's in the lead of the AI revolution.
Sean, I disagree with you on this. I actually think Jensen Huang's comments were just simply flattery and were actually at the core meaningless. Because you could really say that there's a whole series of steps in this process that you could say is at the core of the AI revolution. Is it the people who wrote and created the AI in the first place? I don't know. You could call them the center of this. Or you could say that, when it comes to the chips, well, NVIDIA is making the best chips by far, or rather, they're designing the best chips by far. And the Americans pretty much dominate in the design sphere. So you could say that as far as the chips are concerned, the Americans are at the center of all of this because they're the ones who actually design them. But then, you can say, well, TSMC has the fab that puts them together, but without literally hundreds or thousands of inputs from companies all over the world, including the absolutely crucial lithography machines out of the Dutch company ASML, their factories would be, their fabs would be totally useless. And a big part of, for example, the end process is the packaging, which TSMC only does some of, that's often outsourced to companies like ASE. So there's so many different steps and so many different inputs. To call anything at the heart of it or half of it is just an absolutely nonsense statement, because there's so many different moving parts here that had to all come together to make this happen, and without any one of them, none of this would be in existence. TSMC plays a very important role. So does NVIDIA, so does ChatGPT, and the other software developers, and and ASML. But there's just so many different crucial steps that, again, I think he's just doing it for flattery and make sure that he doesn't lose his suppliers.
I don't think he's going to lose his suppliers anytime soon. TSMC's first priority is usually just Apple, and then followed by basically NVIDIA. And then, the rest of the companies basically line up behind after that. The reason why I do think this is the case is because a lot of the chipsets and what have you for AI is actually developed in conjunction. So when they do chip design, they don't just do it only in the United States and then no other. I mean, obviously, it's a global effort. But primarily, even though the companies are headquartered in the USA, they always visit TSMC. They work really tightly with TSMC and TSMC partners in order to create these chips. Because the creation of the chips isn't just they drop a design, they email it to TSMC, and then TSMC prints them out. Actually, there's a lot of collaboration in order to make these chips happen. This has always been the case with their GPUs as well. So it's a little bit, like you said, it is a very complicated thing. There's a huge supply chain related. As for ASML manufacturing machines, they are critical for Taiwan to produce, but the expertise actually comes from the engineers. They are tools. They are not, it's not like a printer where you just press a button and then out comes a wafer that's perfectly done. There are over 1,000 companies that supply TSMC, also within Taiwan. So the center is indeed ASML machines, lithography machines, but a lot of the techniques and what have you actually take skills from, Taiwan's home-produced expertise and workforce. So it's a combination of all this. Do I necessarily say that Taiwan is the absolute center? I would say it's pretty much the heart of it, because that's how these chips are even made. Like, if you don't have them, it doesn't matter if you have the skills, like I said earlier. It doesn't matter if you have the engineers. You do need the chips to run these AIs on. So there's a big thing right now. It's like you can get AMD video cards or you can get NVIDIA video cards. But with NVIDIA video cards, you can actually run a lot of private AI and it'll do better. So there's a lot of software you can download right now that you can run AI on your home computer, but if it's going to be an Intel chip, probably not going to be good. If it's an NVIDIA chip, it's going to do the work much, much, much faster. So that is something that companies will have to hoard. And, until there's another country that can make these chips or can, integrate with NVIDIA as well as TSMC, then that's that. Yes, Jensen Huang does definitely have some flattery here. He is definitely, it is definitely his only supplier for AI chips, so he has to say that. But I think the center right now is going to be between TSMC and NVIDIA, regardless of where they are in the world.
And of course, Jensen Huang will be coming back in for Computex this year, Sean.
Oh, yeah, sure. And then there's going to be more announcements. And, I mean, the numbers are huge, right? For his, I mean, he's now worth, what, $81.3 billion, you know, from this AI windfall. All these, you know, engineers that work for NVIDIA, oh, my God, they're all wealthy right now, right? So, you know, it is, yeah, he's going to come to Computex. Of course, there's going to be more reveals. AI is, like, the big thing. I mean, a couple of years ago, we were talking about virtual reality. We were talking about crypto. Here's the thing, though. Crypto hasn't had an actual real... I'm going to get so much hate for this. Crypto hasn't had a real everyday application that everybody needs to use every day for the common person. Like, there's not one thing in crypto that will make your life easier for most people immediately. Except for, you know, people like migrant workers that need to send money across, find ways to do that. Sure, you know, that might help them. But whereas AI, you know, at the very minimum, it can definitely correct your grammar. It does way better translation than anything else out there right now. You know, there's practical benefits. Like, if you wanted to, you know, get like a script for your Google Workspace or, you know, Microsoft Word or Excel sheet, actually, and to modify or fix things, it can come up with code for that. It can do all sorts of things that make life easier in that aspect. There's even AI tools that will plan out your entire, like, you know, trip and itinerary, plane tickets for whatever interest you want in whatever country you can think of. So there are practical applications for AI, and it's only projected to grow about 16% every year. And it's going to, you know, and Taiwan has high hopes in this because, oh, about, what is it? Over one third of Taiwan's economy is based on tech. So there's a lot of hopes riding on this right now.
And of course, Jensen Huang, Sean, is the only man I know that can walk around in the middle of the summer in Taipei in a night market in a leather jacket.
Yeah, I predict that in a few years from now, somebody's going to rip off that jacket and you'll find out he was a cyborg all along.
And that's where we have to leave this week on Taiwan This Week. And I've been joined in the studio today by Sean Su.
That's great.
And on the telephone from Taichung by Donovan Smith.
Always great to be here.
And thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Taiwan This Week here on ICRT with me, Gavin Phipps. And there won't be a show next Friday, that being April the 5th, as it's the tomb-sweeping long weekend holiday. But we will be returning on April the 12th with some of the top news from here in Taiwan for that week. But in the meantime, don't forget to check out Taiwan This Week podcast on your favourite podcast app, where you can get access to all our previous shows.
Tune in again next Friday evening at 9 for another informative look at the top stories of the week with Taiwan This Week. And don't forget to also check out our podcast on our website, icrt.com.tw. Now keep it here for more music and news only on ICRT FM 100.